thank y'all for coming. The workshop title is Living Your Faith Out in the Real World. My name is Marcus Nall. I'd like to just start off with a word of prayer real quick, if you don't mind, and then we'll get going. Lord, thank you so much for the opportunity to just share my thoughts and some of the things that I've been through in the last few years and learned. And Lord, I pray that your Spirit would do what it needs to do, Lord. Not let me get in the way. In Jesus' name, amen. First of all, on your handout, there are a couple corrections. The third verse down, I have Matthew 7:14. That's actually Matthew 7, verses 1 through 4. Five verses down, I have Isaiah 16:7. That's 1 Samuel 16:7, not Isaiah 16:7. So let me just tell you a little bit about myself, just to let you know who I am. For the type of work that I do, I'm in the construction world. I'm a carpenter by trade. I do contracting type work. So I have four or five guys that work with me. We do remodel jobs, residential remodel jobs, all the way up to some light duty commercial type work. We build new homes. And I'm from the Northwest Arkansas area, mainly Fayetteville, Springdale, and some of those smaller towns around that area. So how many people in here own their own business? Okay. How many students do we have? College or whatever? All right. And how many people work at a company like a corporation or something like that? And do we have anybody that's retired in here? All right. We got some guys that finally made it for what we're all shooting for, I guess. I work around some pretty rough people from day to day. You see all types in the construction world. But for the most part, I work with some pretty rough people from day to day. So I know what it's like to be out there in the world where not everything's real churchy. And it seems like, I guess it's probably always been like that, but it seems like, man, society's really getting more and more like that. It can be a tough environment sometimes. So let me tell you a little bit about what else I do. I do construction during the day, but I kind of have this part-time hobby of fixing up this old flour mill that I bought a few years ago. And that's consumed a lot of my time the last few years. This thing was built in 1919. It was a flour mill. It was built in 1919, and they produced 2,400,000 pounds of flour a year out of this mill. They shipped it by train. There was a small train that came through town there in Prairie Grove, Arkansas, and they would ship it out of there on the train and sell to the local people, too. All my spare time has been fixing up this old building. Well, I'm trying to do an event center. The building's just really, really interesting. It always has been to me. It was a feed store when I was growing up and lived in town, and there were lots of times that we had a farm about 7 miles from where we actually lived at, and so Dad would say, okay, boys, I want y'all to go feed cows after school today. So we would load the truck up with hay the night before, square bales. Y'all remember square bales? And put about 20 bales on the old truck. We'd drive to school, me and my brother, and then he'd say, now I want y'all to stop at Sherry's Feed Mill, and here's, you know, a couple dollars, and I want you to buy a bag of range cubes and, you know, call the cows up, range cube them, and hay them. So I would go in this old feed store as a high school kid, and it was always very dark in there, but kind of a cool-looking old building. And there was an old man, Mr. Sherry, in there, and I remember lots of times I'd give him a bill of some sort, a 10 or a 5 or whatever it was, and he would give me back a silver dollar as change. And I don't know if it's because he couldn't see good, because it was always dark in that place. But he'd go back there and get his dolly and grab your bags of feed, and you'd back up to the dock and he'd load you on. So I never dreamed that I'd be able to own it, and but it worked out that way. So I have this old feed mill that'll be kind of a lifelong project. It's a big place, has a ton of history with it, and so I've really enjoyed redoing it. So what I'm planning on doing is I'm taking the warehouse section. So I've tried to break this thing up. It's so big, I'm like, well, I can't do this whole project. It'd take me the rest of my life to restore this thing. So I took what was called the warehouse section, and that's where Mr. Sherry would keep his feed at that he would actually use. And that section we're going to use for events. You might have a wedding there or a wedding reception or a birthday party or something like that. Just some way to bring in some income to save the building. So it's been a long process. We had to redo all the rafters in it and timbers in it, and we sawed all that ourselves out of dead trees on my parents' farm. So, been a fun project. So, y'all know a little bit about me. In the process of that, word kind of got around town that I was into this restoring old building stuff. So, there was a Presbyterian Church, and it actually was the first church in our area. So they started in 1832, and the congregation, like a lot of old churches, had dwindled to four or five people. So before the church got shut down, they came to me. They went to several other people, but they eventually came to me and said, "Hey, would you be interested in purchasing the church and saving the church? Because there's so much history on this piece of property. We don't want to see the church get torn down and apartments built here." So this is actually the third church that's been on the property. Here's a picture of the church. Looks like your traditional old church. We'll pass this around too. So I said, "Yeah, you know, I might be interested in doing something with the church." So we purchased the church, and the church is now going to work as a place for weddings, and then we might have receptions at the mill. So that's the concept. We're not done with it yet. But the church has a lot of history behind it. There was a battle, a Civil War battle in our town of Prairie Grove. And so when General Hindman, the Confederate general, came to town, the North was advancing towards the South. They knew they were coming, so the Confederates come into town, and General Hyman sets up his headquarters at this church, and he directs the battle from the church. He came about 11 o'clock that morning, and the battle happened that day and into the evening. And then eventually the Confederates ran out of ammunition. They used all their ammunition. It was a draw, but the Confederates retreated back to Van Buren, leaving the Union in control of our town, as well as Jayhawkers and everything else. So the Union comes and takes control of the church, and they were going to stay the winter there in Prairie Grove, occupy the territory. And so they destroyed the church. The historians say that they think they tore it down first and used the lumber to build their winter quarters where they were going to stay. And then they burned the rest of the church. Another interesting fact about the church is it has old curved pews in it. And those pews were bought in 1905. The church finally got together and petitioned the government for funds since the Union had burned their church. And they got their money in 1906, and they bought these pews with that money that they got. They got about, I think it was $800. 226 of it went to the lawyers, and the rest of it went to the pews and maybe the bell. Sounds about right, doesn't it? So no offense if you're a lawyer. That brings us to our first point that we're going to get to. Let me read you a story. This is an account of two Union soldiers that walked to the church the night of the battle. General Hindman comes in, he takes over the church, he runs the battle from the church, but the wounded are coming in so fast that they moved Hindman out of the building and the surgeons took over the church. And this is an account from two Union soldiers. Now, I don't know how the Union soldiers were able to get into the church. If you're at war, I'd have shot them, but for whatever reason, they were able to walk into the church. I don't know if they were dressed like Confederates or maybe it was just mayhem. I don't know. But this is the account from one of their journals. Arkansas seceded from the United States government on May 6, 1861, and joined the Confederacy. On December 7, 1862, Union and Confederate armies fought a bloody battle on what is now called the Prairie Grove Historic Battlefield State Park, less than 2 miles from what the soldiers called the Prairie Grove Church. About a day before the battle began, Confederate General Thomas C. Hindman reached Prairie Grove at about 11 a.m. and briefly established his headquarters in an old church house. During the first day of the battle, wounded Confederate soldiers were taken to the Prairie Grove Church, where surgeons with the Southern Army tried in vain to keep up with the incoming injured. Toward sunset on December 7th, two Union soldiers with the 20th Wisconsin Infantry, John Henry Smith and Thomas P. Murray, walked from the battlefield toward the makeshift hospital. Some years later, Smith wrote what they came upon. So this is Smith's account here. "A church that had been taken possession of for a hospital, and there, O merciful God, what a sight met our eyes. All around the church laid 3 or 4 ranks of wounded soldiers, placed side by side. Dozens of them dying for want of surgical aid, some bleeding to death while a bandage around a leg or arm would have saved their lives, but no one was allowed to touch them but a surgeon with a diploma. So you see a great many of the men outside, patiently waiting for the aid that came too late, died for want of help. With heavy hearts we look inside the church. It is brightly lighted, and rows of wounded men laid on the floor all around the four walls. And in the center of the room, long tables were erected where wounded men were laid, and the surgeons and their assistants were busy cutting and sawing off legs and arms and doing surgical work of all kinds of wounds. The men who were being treated first, of course, were the commissioned officers. The private soldiers had to wait until all the men of rank were attended to, as each regiment only had one surgeon and one assistant. It is easy to see how the poor boys outside on a frosty December night, with the sky for a covering, must have suffered before surgical aid reached them. Tired, wounded, and cold, chilled through from loss of blood, most of them had been without food for 36 hours. We then stepped outside the church again and looked over the rows of wounded as they lay side by side in the cold. What an interesting story. This took place in a church. And it seems like that's kind of what we do in church, in a way. We take the person that's the successful businessman or the person who's got it all together, and we want to disciple them or win them, when these other guys that have just as much importance to God lay outside and bleed to death. It's just something to think about. Just an interesting story. It's interesting that it took place in a church. And I'm not saying anything bad about the church. Church is a good place. We should go to church and all that. But we shouldn't look past other people. So some of the people in the construction world that I work with are some of the people that we might look over. You know, anybody got any thoughts about that story? Something I'm missing? Any points you could bring out there?
One thing that stood out to me was that it required they needed the degreed surgeon to do the work, whereas anybody could have run around putting bandages on people. And that's kind of the layman versus the paid pastor.
Very good point. Very good point. Very good point. Matter of fact, I'd like to talk about that point a little bit. Could somebody look up Romans 10:15?
And how are they to preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the good news.
Thank you. How beautiful are the feet of those that bring the good news, preach the good news. Now I want to ask y'all a question. I'm sure most of y'all here are familiar with the story of where Jesus washed the disciples' feet. Why did Jesus wash the disciples' feet? Anybody got any thoughts? My preacher asked this a few weeks ago, and it just got me to thinking a little bit. And then he went on to answer the question that he asked by reading the text. And he talked about Jesus being a servant and showing them how to be a servant. And I think that is very true. But the thought that occurred to me was those guys that he washed their feet were the 12 disciples. Those were the ones that were going to take the gospel to all of humanity. How poetic for Jesus to kneel down and wash their feet. The very feet that were going to bring the good news to all of humanity, pretty much. Just something to think on. That's what we are. That's the layman. That's us. We're the ones that are going to take the gospel. If we don't do it, it's not always up to the paid preacher. Obviously, it's up to us everyday people to carry the gospel. So, John 13:4-5. Has anybody got that?
So, he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him.
So that's the account of Jesus washing their feet. You know, and all it would have taken to save those guys' lives, those private soldiers or whoever they were laying on the ground, might just be a tourniquet or a bandage. But in the Confederacy, nobody could see them once you were wounded except a surgeon with a diploma. So,
makes you wonder what seminary James, Peter, and John went to.
Yeah, he said it makes you wonder what seminary James, Peter, and John went to. So,
and he washed Judas's feet.
Yeah, he washed Judas's feet too. Judas was in the bunch.
Yep.
Why do you think he did that? Any thoughts?
He loved him as much as he did the others.
So his soul mattered too.
Yes, absolutely.
Wow.
Like one of those privates you're talking about.
Right.
The lieutenant. Yeah.
Right. Wow. Very interesting. Can anybody quote Romans 3:23 for me? Somebody speak up.
For everyone has sinned, we all fall short of God's glorious standard.
Okay. So we've all sinned. We're all sinners. No, we're not. You're not any better than anybody else. I'm not any better than anybody else. I'm not any better than those guys that work with me that may be rough around the edges. We're all sinners. And I think that's a good point that needs to be brought out. And just your attitude towards other people. We're all sinners. You sin too. 1 Samuel 16:7, but the Lord said to Samuel, do not look at the outward appearance or the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For God sees not as man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. Just the same point again, that those private soldiers, God looks on them, same as he does the other guy inside on the table getting seen about. Matthew 7:1-4. Could somebody read Matthew 7:1-4 for me?
Do not judge, or you too will be judged. For in the same way you judge others, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when all the time there's a plank in your own eye?
Very good. Thank you. So just trying to make that same point again. And you know, early on for me, when I was about 20, I met with a navigator who met with me a lot. After a while, I got to thinking maybe I was a little bit better, because this guy's paying quite a bit of attention to me. I've learned real quick that's not the case. One of the guys that works with me is a real character. His name's Denny. He's a true Arkansan. He grew up in the hills there in Arkansas. He looks like Grizzly Adams. He's a big guy. He's got this full beard. For instance, some of the things that he's done in his life, amongst doing construction most of the time, he was a trapper. And he actually lived for a whole season, a whole winter, in the hills. And he would find a bluff shelter, sleep under it, build him a fire. I don't know, carried a sleeping bag with him. He'd stay out there and he trapped for a whole winter. And every once in a while, he'd find an old abandoned shack out in the woods and he'd stay in that. And he tells a story of one winter. He was out there and he'd found this old abandoned shack, and it had a little dugout basement under it. And down in there, he found a Bible. Didn't have the covers on it, but he found a Bible. And that winter, by firelight or his lamp, he read the whole Bible all the way through. So he works with me in the construction world. He's about 60, something like that. Not in the best health. He smoked most of his life and stuff like that. I hadn't been just extremely vocal about my Christianity. I mean, we had work to do and we had customers, and I had to, I work for the customer and I get paid by the customer, and we've got to get that job done. We don't have time necessarily to kumbaya, by the campfire. One thing that I'd always tried to do within my business and with my guys, I just try to be trustworthy. And that brings us to the key verse here of the whole deal, which is 1 Corinthians 4:1-2. You might look that up, 1 Corinthians 4:1-2. And I'm going to try to quote it, because that's one of my memory verses. And I'm going to quote it out of the New American Standard. And it says, let a man regard us in this manner, as servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. Moreover, it is required of stewards that one be found trustworthy. 1 Corinthians 4:1-2. Without really knowing it, I was modeling that to Denny. And so he noticed that we were trying to be trustworthy in what we did. If we had extra material, we'd take that back to the lumberyard, get a credit, give that back to the customer. As I thought about that verse, what really grabbed me was let a man regard us in this manner. And the thought came to me, how am I regarded by others? How do they regard me? How do they think of you? The people that you work with, how do they regard you? According to this verse, God says that we're stewards of the mysteries of God. If you're a steward, so let's say Denny doesn't know how God really works, right? Well, if he doesn't trust me in everyday life, he's not going to trust me to tell him about God. Somebody give me some thoughts on that. What does it mean to be trustworthy? What does it mean to be, how does somebody regard you? And why is that important?
I've heard it said that you need to earn the right to be heard. Right or wrong, people tend to think, okay, this guy is good in this area, so he's good in all other areas. professional sports is an interesting example. Oh, you know, greatest football player, greatest basketball player. So they must know about interpersonal relationships and how to treat other people and be trustworthy and, you know, religious things and all this kind of stuff. So if we're good in whatever we do, people tend to give more credence to what we say in other areas as well.
Very well put.
My son and I went to the funeral of a friend of his yesterday, 18 years old.
Oh, wow.
And we had three funerals this week, 18, 17, 15.
Oh, my goodness.
But the question was asked, what would people say about you? Like they did about Kyle. And this this verse, that's what I see in it. You know, what at the core, what do people think about you?
Right.
What's going to remember about you? What's going to stand out?
Right. Yeah, what else is there in the end? These funerals, were they all tied? Were they in an accident together?
The three boys were in a car that ran off the road in Rockville.
Wow.
Last Sunday. So.
Wow.
This is over in Altus.
Okay.
I just retired just this last year. And one of the things at work that I tried to do is I tried to make sure that, well, I never said anything, but the guys that I moved from one department to another one, and the guys there, I never said anything about their language, but they cleaned it up big time.
Yeah, just knowing that you were there.
Yeah, just knowing that, you know, and the main thing is they always knew that they could trust me, that if I found their tools, I'd bring them back to them. And, you know, you never take anything home from the company. You always do what you mean and live your life like, you know, God would want you to live it. And it turned them. I turned some men around. I had men call back and thank me for being, you know, being a witness there.
How do you think they knew you were a Christian? Did you say something, or sometimes, or?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I would quote. You know, quoting scripture is very important. And you know, people may not ever remember anything you say, but they'll remember what God's Word says.
Mm-hmm.
And. You know, there's verses in there you can quote that they take as being just little idioms and stuff, but, you know, they know, they'll remember God's Word. They may never remember anything else you say,
mm-hmm.
but His Word will not return to you void.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I decided one day if they want to fire me, that they're going to fire me because I'm a Christian, not because of anything I did there. You know, I wanted to make sure God's Word got out.
Right.
And you never know when a person's going to be there 6 years or, you know, 26 years.
Right.
And so you witness to them as if it might be the last time you get to talk to them.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I'm not retired. I'm just tired.
I understand.
Men want me to be respected. And I know for a long time I've dealt with the issue of, you know, interacting with people, and sometimes we want it to look good for personal reasons. But I know that I know, looking back at my history, a lot of times I've had to just, you know, suck it up and accept the fact that not everybody's going to look at me well. But they need to look at me well for God's sake. And so I know through the years I've tried to do well at my work so that God would be glorified and I'd have a position to speak to other people. And so eventually, you know, circumstances made me manager, and I've been able to do things for the last year that have given me a better position to speak to other people. So I think our credibility plays a big part, but we need to do it for God and not for...
You don't need to do it necessarily for build yourself up or whatever, but your main goal is for God, yeah, for His glory, not yours. Yeah, very good. Anybody else? Yes.
I remember listening to part of his testimony, and he was sharing an incident where someone was asking him to do something and he really didn't feel like doing it. they said, to protect my testimony, I served this person by doing what he wanted to do. And I often think about that at work, that how am I for my testimony and how I am serving others.
Right. Very well said. Anybody else?
What I hear in this verse is a message about credibility and how you should live to regard that credibility, otherwise you won't encounter any followers.
Right.
Nobody wants to follow a guy they can't trust.
Right.
And it's not so much about what people think about you after you're gone, but what about people think about you now.
Now.
Now that they're able to follow you.
Yeah. Yes. That's very good.
When I just wanted to add this, when I first went to work there, a lot of the guys would make fun of me. They'd leave trash in my car, like porno and stuff. They'd see me throw it away and stuff. But, you know, the same people who were making fun of me 35 years ago are now working in churches. They're involved. They're leading in the churches. And they had a life change over the years, but they were the ones that made the most fun of you 30 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you
never know, do you?
You never know.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me continue the story with Denny a little bit, the mountain man. Denny still works with me every day. Matter of fact, he's working today while I'm here. But we did a job that was a few hours away, and so we all rode together in the same truck, the whole crew. And boy, you're talking about some fun now. We had a lot of fun driving back and forth and just some camaraderie. But Denny told me in one of those trips, actually it was just me and Denny on this particular trip, and he said, I know God sent me to work for you for a reason. He said, I just know it. He said, you're different. He said, I just see so much peace in you. And there's another gentleman that works with me, James. He's my main superintendent. And James is a Christian and an outspoken Christian. And he's had a lot of discussions with Denny about religious type things. And he said, you and James are different. Y'all just have a lot of, you know, you're just peaceful. Even though I didn't beat Denny over the head with the gospel, he's attracted because he sees something different. He sees, hopefully, the Spirit of God in me. So sometimes your actions and your spirit and who you are maybe speaks more than actually giving them a tract or something that might turn them off. I guess I'm saying this to say, be who you are. Be real. You don't always have to use churchy words, and you don't always have to invite somebody to church to win them to Christ. And there's nothing wrong with inviting somebody to church, but don't you think that we ought to win a person to Christ before they go to church? You know, because church is a mess. It's just people. You know, it's messy. Church can be messy when you've got a bunch of people who aren't healthy all together. You kind of... Anyway, that's my tidbit on that. Funny story, me and Denny, I had a friend that had helped me build my personal house, a good friend. He had since moved to Colorado and was building a house out there. And I said, hey, I want to return the favor. You helped me a bunch on my house. I want to come help you frame your house. And so Denny went with me. Me and him rode together. I had a pretty new truck, not brand new, but new to me. Never been smoked in, nothing like that. Well, I've got Denny with me. We're riding all the way to Colorado. He said, now, I'm going to have to smoke. And I said, well, you can't smoke in my truck. Well, you won't. I'll just roll down the window and hang my head out the window. I was like, no smoking, period, you know. He did pretty good. We'd stop to get gas. He'd smoke a cigarette. And one time on the way down there, he said, man, I've got to have a cigarette. I said, roll down the window. That's fine. So he rolls down the window and smokes a cigarette. No big deal, you know. Well, on the way back, I was worn out. We'd worked hard for a week and a half, just nonstop, daylight to dark. And I was worn out. We got out on the interstate. And I said, man, Denny said, I'm so tired. He said, you want me to drive? I was like, yeah, would you drive? I took one good shirt with me on this trip. You know, when you go somewhere like that, you mainly take work clothes, but you thought, well, we might go out to supper or something. We might go to church on Sunday. So I had hung a shirt behind the driver's side. It was a four-door truck. Hung it right behind the driver's side. Well, I was over there about halfway asleep. My eyes nodding off pretty good. And I hear the window come down. And then I smell the smoke, you know. And I thought, oh, I'm not even going to. You know, he's kind of in the in-between sleep where you're not really asleep, but you're not really awake. And then I hear the back window go down. And I hear my shirt, my good shirt, my best shirt, kind of flapping in the wind. And I was trying to kind of wake up to see what was going on. I was starting to sit up, and I hear this whoosh. I look back, and there goes my shirt flying through the air. I was like, Denny, that was my best shirt. You want me to turn around? I was like, we're going 70 miles an hour. We got a camper trailer behind us. I said, we can't turn around. Just keep going. So that's a funny story about Denny. Lost my shirt. Anyway, but things like that happen. That's part of it. It's part of it. There's going to be some things that don't work out like you want. Yeah, she was. I wasn't going to tell her about it. I had told somebody else that story, and I don't know how she found out, but she found out about it and questioned me about it. Well, it wasn't time to turn around and go get it, so we'll just have to buy another one. 1 Corinthians 9:22. Can somebody quote or read 1 Corinthians 9:22?
The weak have become weak, and I might win the weak. I have become all things to all people, that by all means I might save some.
Okay. What does that mean? You make any thoughts on that?
Paul's just talking about him being flexible depending on which group of people he was with. And so he tried to, you know, try to fit in, but still maintain who he was.
So if they're all sitting around smoking dope, does that mean you smoke with them?
No. I mean, and this happened to me. This happened to me last week. I went out to dinner with the crew, and they're all drinking beer like crazy.
Yeah.
And I'm drinking water.
Right.
And they're talking trash, and I'm being quiet.
Right.
And I just endured all the way to the end, and then I helped them get back to the hotel.
Right.
I was like their designated walker. But so yeah, just being myself, knowing, you know, I was true to who I was.
Right.
Christ.
Anybody else got anything to say about that?
I'm a school teacher, so I work with people with interesting viewpoints. And it's real important to me that they see me as a normal person. They know I'm a Christian. They know I'm real serious about it. But if they want, I don't want them to feel like they can't curse around me. If they want to, I'm not going to judge them. So I don't want them to feel judged because of who I am. I want them to feel comfortable. I want them to know when my kids mess up that I have kids that are normal just like they have kids that are normal. I want them to know and that really, you know, I'm in a relationship with Jesus and that's what makes a difference. But I'm just like them other than that. And so that's important to me that they feel that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, I hope they do. I think they do. I mean, they don't mind cursing around. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like they have filthy mouths, but you know,
right.
They'll say words here right. And there. And I don't cringe. I'm just like, oh, it's interesting.
That is huge, I think. I think that is just a huge thing for people to feel comfortable. Like you're not going to judge them. I think that's a huge thing in being able to earn their respect, to be able at some point share the gospel with them. You have to build that relationship, and you can't have much relationship if you're judging that person all the time. So
your example with Dennis is a perfect example of what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Dennis is just as important as anybody else.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not going to judge him. I'm a sinner too. Isn't it in John where it says if you haven't sinned, you say you haven't sinned, you're a liar? Howard?
A thread through all of this is we need to be competent at what we do. You know, as somebody Wag once said, somebody was so earthly minded they were no, or so heavenly minded they were no earthly good. If you're spending all your time as a teacher or as a carpenter or whatever preaching, and you don't do a good job teaching, you don't do a good job building the homes or whatever, you've totally destroyed. You haven't become the weak became as weak, and the Greek as a Greek, and a Jew as a Jew. You need to be competent. You need to be good at what you're doing to earn that respect, and so that you are a normal person, but somebody who is trustworthy and somebody that they can talk to.
And that leads directly into that 1 Peter 3:15, to be ready to give an account for the hope that is within you. We build that relationship and earn their trust so that at some point we can have that opportunity to tell them why we have hope, why we have peace.
The word with reverence and gentleness.
Very good. He said with reverence and gentleness is the rest of that verse that I left off. Yeah. Go ahead.
Truth and love, they go together there too.
Yeah.
There's a proverb that says, see a man that is skilled in his work, he will stand before kings. He will not stand before average people. So that credibility is key.
Yeah, and that's true. That's true. That's been true in my life. I've worked for some pretty influential people. Some of y'all have probably shopped at their stores, and they're the type of place that's always saving. And I've worked directly for those people. So, and I'm not saying I'm super skilled. I just try to do the best that I can. You know what I mean? But that proverb is a true proverb. It's been true in my life. Now we're going to switch gears a little bit, and we're going to talk a little bit about farming. Anybody in here a farmer? Does anybody farm?
Have been.
Have been? Okay. Well, y'all probably know dairy farmer. So Isaiah 28:24. Can somebody read Isaiah 28:24?
Doth the plowman plow all day to sow that he open and break the clods of his ground?
Okay, thank you. This farmer's not always plowing, but he's not always harvesting. He's not always planting. He does different things. It's just a simple rule that something has to be planted before it can be harvested. Is that correct? Can't harvest if you don't plant. Proverbs 20, verse 4, if you're too lazy to plow, you'll have no food at the harvest. So just that point that something has to be planted before it's harvested. Sometimes we go out and we try to harvest first, but nothing's ever been planted. We haven't planted or somebody else hasn't planted, therefore we can't harvest. I just want to bring up the simple point that you can't win somebody to Christ if they're not there yet. Y'all kind of on track with me there? When I bought the old feed mill, my neighbor across the street had restored a bunch of tractors. He was selling his tractors. I had my eye on this one. I thought it was really sharp. It's a Farmall F12. It's a 1937 model. Everybody see that? Well, I asked Mr. Houston. I said, well, Mr., I'm going to pass this around. I said, Mr. Houston, he's the gentleman who had restored it. I said, I didn't know anything about old tractors. I said, how did it get the name F12? And he looked at me like I was kind of not quite all there, kind of turned his head sideways. He said, well, it's a Farmall and it's 12 horsepower. And I said, oh, F12. And I thought, my lawnmower has more horsepower than 12 horsepowers. And he said, well, it's a different kind of horsepower, he said. And it is. That thing will really pull. To go with the tractor in our event center, we needed some props around, so we found an old wheat drill. See the wheat drill hooked on the back of the tractor here? We found this old wheat drill, and Mr. Houston is very mechanically inclined, and he knows how this old farm stuff works. I don't know how it works. I thought, well, that ought to be pretty simple. It's got some wood boxes on the top that the grain goes in. We'll just put some new wood pieces on there, and we'll have us a grain drill. Well, it wasn't quite that simple. There's a lot of moving parts on a wheat drill that I didn't know about, and all of those were rusted or some were missing. And so Mr. Houston, he began restoring the wheat drill for us, and I've learned quite a bit about the wheat drill. The wheat drill has three different boxes on this particular one. And so there is a box for all your bigger seeds, but if you were planting grass, there's a little small box for smaller seeds. And then there's a box for fertilizer. So it can do multiple things. It can fertilize and plant at the same time. But first, that's not a no-till drill. I guess those maybe didn't come along till later. The field has to be plowed first to plant something with it. So I like to deer hunt. So this next year, I'm going to plow something up and I'm going to plant something with that wheat drill. And I hope. And so we'll see if it works. But just the fact that we need to be doing multiple things at once. We don't need to always be plowing, we don't need to always be planting, and we don't need to always be harvesting. We need to be doing several things, I think, at once. Can y'all relate to that in with different people that you work with? Anybody got any thoughts about planting, plowing, and harvesting, and how that relates to your coworkers? fertilizing.
Yeah, the part, you know, the part you're talking about there as far as preparing the ground, I'd say our society today, the majority of our society today needs to have, you know, the ground needs to be prepared with them. And you can't do it by just, you know, just bringing in the gospel right away.
Right.
And I read a book here recently from Tim Mulberg. And it's called I Beg to Differ. The name of the book.
Okay.
And in there, there's three questions. I've been using those three questions, and they work.
Okay.
They work great. The first question is, once you, you know, once you kind of build some rapport as far as where they work, about the family, about the kids, about the recreation and stuff like that.
So you kind of draw them out.
You draw them out and just kind of, you know, build that rapport. But then once you do get into kind of a more serious conversation with them, as you're going through this process of building a relationship, you ask this first question is, what do you believe?
What do you believe is the first question you ask.
And then you do this. And you listen for a whole hour.
Okay. Just let them talk.
Just let them talk. And you just note things. If you have to write it down, fine. But just note it in your mind what they believe. And then, try to set up another time when you can get together.
Okay.
And the next time you meet, you ask the second question. And the second question you ask is, why do you believe what you believe? And you go through that.
Seems logical.
And you're looking for some kernels in there, you know, kernels of information that you can use in the third time you meet, where you can talk about common ground. And then once you establish that common ground, now you've established that relationship.
Right.
And you can go from there. And that's, we're talking about somebody that you've never met before.
Right. Right. So a total, not very much time in a whole scheme of things is that to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. What was his third thing?
Just from the second question, you're going to pick out some things that you're going to use in the next time you meet, the third time you meet, and then that's where you're going to see where you have common ground, and then from that common ground is where you're going to build. And you just got to meet them where they're at, just like you've said.
Yeah.
Meet them where they're at, and just realize that in our society today, there is a lot of unbelief out there.
Yeah.
You just got to meet them where they're at. And
there are people that are really hurting out there. That's what I've found. There are people that are really, really hurting. There's real problems out there, and it's people that you work with every day, and you may not know it. You may not even know it. You know, people are good at hiding stuff. They're good at putting up walls. And until somebody asks them a question or engages them, you never know. So,
sort of kind of follow your example of farming. Solomon wrote that there's a time to plant, a time to harvest. Farming takes time. You do things in season, then you wait. And I think a lot of times with guys, we like to fix things and we like to fix people. Sometimes we need to, like I said, just listen.
Mm-hmm.
Not have an answer, not have a pat verse you go to and say this fixes everything, but let them discover that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because some of the ones that more things are caught than taught, and they need to see that for themselves or become a reality.
Yes, absolutely. Things are caught and not taught, it seems to be. I mean, there's some of both, but it sure seems to be that way with me. Of course, I've been taught some things, and hopefully I've learned some of them, but I've caught a whole lot of stuff over the years. Now, I mentioned Mr. Houston, the one who's helped me with my tractor. This is Mr. Houston right here. He's 85. We were working on a project on one of these plows that we were working on, and at the time, I was 42 years old. I'm 44 now. I was working, and it was I knew that it was Mr. Houston's birthday somehow. And I said, "Mr. Houston, how old are you?" And he said, "Well, I'm 84. And I said, "Well, you're double my age." And I was 42. He was 84 at the time. And he's a good Christian man. He told me one day, he said, "I'm not afraid of dying. I know where I'm going." Just a great man. He's standing here with my granddad's corn planter. My mom had it in her flower garden for years, and I rescued it and decided that I was going to put some new handles on it. I made the handles out of some of the oak that we cut off my dad's farm, and Mr. Houston helped me get it working. He asked me, he said, "Well, how far do you want me to go with this thing?" I said, "Well, I want to be able to plant corn with it." So he's got it where it's able to plant corn now. This is a really interesting piece of machinery. It changed history a little bit. It's a Deere and Mansur. And I've got a story about this. So does anybody know how John Deere really got going strong? Steel plow and then the planter. One of the first few things that they did. This planter right here revolutionized corn planting. And I'm going to read out of the Ageless Iron Tractor magazine about these corn planters. "The rotary drop corn planter was the brainchild of Alva Mansur and Charles Deere." That's John Deere's son. They formed Deere and Mansur. That company would be absorbed into Deere and Company in 1911. Prior to Deere and Mansur's breakthrough, mechanical corn planters primarily employed a plate with holes large enough to hold several seeds for hill dropping. This resulted in multiple seeds being placed in a cluster. The number of seeds in a hill varied, and accordingly, so did the yields. Deere and Mansur's invention created a metering mechanism that doled out single seeds. In doing so, the rotary drop corn planter was 65% to 85% more accurate than any on the market. So that put them as one of the largest producers of a corn planter, because all the farmers learned, hey, I'm not getting very good yield. So prior to that, I guess you scattered the seed, or you went along by hand, you dropped it in the ground, but this was a mechanical thing that you could go behind your mule or your horse, and it would meter out the seed one at a time, every 4 or 6 inches, and it would drop a seed. So in this one that Mr. Houston worked on here for me, it has a plate in the bottom and a corn seed. It's in the bottom of this bin right here. A corn seed will fall, corn kernel will fall down into a little slot, and as the wheel is turned, it moves that around and drops it in the hole. Prior to that, seeds were dropped, it says, 4 to 6 at a time. So what would happen, obviously, is those seeds are all competing for the same nutrients. So your yields were not good at all. They weren't getting a whole lot of corn. I have an ear of corn here. The next thing that John Deere did that really galvanized them as a company, they didn't give up. Other people started copying after a few years what Deere and Mansur were doing. And so they were kind of catching up with them. Well, Deere and Mansur got together with their engineers and they said, "We got to go further. We got to do more. We got to be more accurate. We got to build a better corn planter." So they came up with the 999, longest produced corn planter ever, right here. Did any of y'all's granddads or any of y'all ever have a 999? It was produced from 1877 to 1957. It was such a good corn planter. And what they did was different is they had less moving parts than everybody else. And then, to be more accurate, break some of these off here. Whoops, there go a few. A seed would fall in this picture I showed you of my granddad's corn planter here. A seed would just fall down flat like this. Well, what would happen is every once in a while you get two seeds at once. So John Deere said, "You know what? Corn lengths and widths vary, but their thickness this way doesn't vary very much. They're very consistent that way, a corn seed is." So they made their slots a little bit different, and that changed, that made them 15% more accurate. So now you got a corn planter that's almost 100% accurate. It drops a seed every time it goes 4 or 6 inches and doesn't drop two seeds. It's dropping one at a time. So that's how John Deere became very, very popular and became the brand that we know today, is they changed the way they turned that corn seed in that planter. This is the 999 longest produced corn planter in the world. I'll send these pictures around so y'all can look at them. Now, I want to talk a little bit just about my story. I met with a navigator, a local navigator. He met with me for several years. For once a week, he would meet with me. Maybe sometimes twice a week, we'd do some things. Usually in the mornings, we'd get together before work. We'd read the Bible, study together, taught me to memorize scripture. He did that for several years before I really kind of caught on what all was going on here. I look back over that time as a very special time for me. He's still my friend of the day. He's here at the conference with me, and we still keep in touch, which I think is huge in a person's life. Jesus said in John, he's talking about his disciples, and he says he had loved his disciples during his ministry on earth, and now he loved them to the very end. So he didn't give up on the guys, his 12 disciples. He kept on with them all the way to the end. And I think that's important. I hope we're able as a group to do that with the people that we work with and encounter and hopefully someday win to Christ and disciple. I just want to reiterate with the story of the corn planter that one seed at a time is really, really important. I don't think I would be spiritually where I'm at unless somebody had taken one seed and really nurtured that seed, not a group of seeds. Anybody got any thoughts about that? The difference between one seed versus a group of seeds and how that relates to Christianity and to your spiritual life?
I'll give you an example.
Okay.
I was meeting with two guys at a time. They both had really good marriages.
Right.
Another guy wanted to start meeting with us, and we started meeting with him, and I noticed he wasn't talking very much.
Right.
So I finally figured out I've learned to customize my discipleship. He heard these guys talking about their marriages doing so good, but he wouldn't talk about his. So I end up getting to meet with him one-on-one.
Yeah.
And then he opened up to me some of the problems he had in his marriage, but he wasn't going to do it in front of this group.
Right.
He never would have. I don't think he'd ever grown if he'd have stayed in that group. And that's the case of one seed.
That is a very powerful story. It's simple, but it's very true. That's the truth. Hard to share in a group because you're afraid you're going to be rejected or made fun of or you're different. But that one seed planted sometimes can have the highest yields.
Yeah.
And somebody else. Yeah, go ahead.
A couple of years ago at our church, we offered some different topics of classes on Sunday night. And we had this one class. I can't remember what it was about, but only one couple signed up to go. And we thought, well, we should maybe cancel the class. What should we do? But we went ahead, persevered, went through the class. Well, about 6 months later, that couple were saved.
Wow.
And in visiting with them, they said, one of the reasons we stuck with church is because you got stuck with us in that class. And we had one-on-one with that teacher, and that made such a difference in their lives. And we
right.
almost canceled.
Right.
But we should never discount just because it's one person or two people. You're still doing kingdom work.
Mm-hmm. And that could produce a huge harvest in the end. So it might not be real quick on the front end, but on the long end, it could be huge. I mean, just look. If these are all corn seeds, and we planted each one, and each one reached maturity and produced more corn seeds, holy cow, this one kernel of corn right here could make a whole field of corn over several seasons. Very, very interesting.
Gene Moore said once that, that my Sunday school class is my fishing pond, but I'm looking for the one guy out of that whole class who really wants to go on and really wants to grow. And that's why I'm doing that class. Identify that one man. And that man, I'm going to make it.
Mm-hmm. I remember hearing him say that at this conference probably. So he was just saying that Gene Moore taught Sunday school class and he used that Sunday school class as a fishing pond to find one guy that he could disciple and see that guy go further. So that same illustration of planting that one seed and seeing the yields really come high. Yeah, absolutely.
I've noticed with my coworkers, I try to go to lunch with them and build relationships. And I always try to go to lunch with just one guy. Because I've noticed if I go with two or three or four guys, talk just kind of gets, it's not coarse or anything, but it's useless talk.
Right.
Sports or whatever, and it never gets deep. But when I go with one guy, I can actually dig deep and kind of get into their life. And I've noticed guys tend to not want to go to lunch one-on-one because I think they know that. Hey, you want to go to lunch? Yeah, can I invite Dan and Kyle and Seth? Sure, why not? And usually guys don't come. It's just one-on-one. Those are usually the best time.
Yeah.
But I found that with that one-on-one, you can just go deeper.
Well, a guy wants to be, you know, you want to be made in, you want to feel important, and you want to be able to tell your story. And I don't know, there's just something different about it being one-on-one versus a group.
Do you see any examples of Jesus doing that?
That's a good question. Anybody know any examples of Jesus doing one-on-one?
Samaritan woman?
That wasn't extended, though. It was a once encounter.
That's a good point. That's something
Most of his was small group, right?
Paul and Timothy, I don't know about Jesus, but Paul and Timothy, you know, Paul is on his deathbed when he goes to Timothy and says, carry on, take the torch. I'm passing this to you. It's your responsibility. That's a very good question and something that we ought to all consider and think about and maybe pray about that, and that's something that I continue to want to look for.
So one of the things, I guess, to answer some of the questions you were asking before, one of the things that I see people can see in your life is a direction, is a mission, is a vision. You can tell when people are determined or are pointed in a direction. You can tell people that are driven, right? If people want to be the best of the best, if people want to do something, you see that in them, and that overpours to you. I mean, in small groups, you have to be very, very intentional about moving it in a direction. You have to be very intentional about what your mission is, about what you're trying to accomplish. And Jesus was that way. That's what makes small groups successful. You can be intentional one-on-one, but Jesus didn't need that. I mean, he was very driven, and that was what attracts people to you as a Christian, what should attract people to you as a Christian, is your mission, your vision, to become closer to God and to show his love, to show that relationship, that should overflow in your life on a daily basis. And that mission should be aligned with the things that you're doing.
Nicodemus came to Jesus one-on-one. The woman at the well came to Jesus one-on-one. Or he went to them. And I think many times one-on-one is a very good thing because there's no distractions.
I know it's very true in my life, for me. You know, I was in small groups, didn't seem to go anywhere for me. I had to be challenged one-on-one. But he brings up a very good point. Where's that at in the Scripture? Go ahead.
Well, I really appreciate the analogy with the seeds. It's easy to understand that you're talking about corn seeds.
Right.
Well, people are different seeds of different trees and different, you know, they become different things. Some grow just to be flowers that people can just appreciate visually, while others produce, you know, something that you eat.
Right.
It's really important to recognize, especially if you're in a group of people, where those common lines are. Because all seeds, I think we can agree, all seeds need water. Seeds need sunshine. And that's where Jesus is. You know, Jesus is that kind of like universal, everybody needs at least this much.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you pick your groups apart, you can start to see what you know, path is more, or what specific needs and nutrients are.
Right, what they need, what that individual seed needs. Yeah.
I think what Jesus modeled was relationships, and that's what's going to be.
That's what makes the difference. Yeah.
Yeah. The example of him spending time with the three, a little more than the group of 12.
Right.
There's even a bigger group of disciples than the 12.
That's true, yeah.
His focus was on relationships.
Right.
Another example of that is even in the small groups, he would be personal. Peter, who do you say that I am?
Yeah.
And so it was the relationship that transcended maybe the group.
Right.
So that's an element of it.
Right. I think that's very good. Yeah. Okay, we're going to wrap up. I think our time's about gone. And I want to end with Luke 8:15. And so that's the story of the seeds that get scattered and they fall on the different soil. And Luke 8:15 is the one that falls on the good soil. And that's where we want to be at. It's one of my memory verses, and I'm going to actually read this to you. And the seeds that fell on the good soil represent honest, good-hearted people who hear God's word, cling to it, and patiently produce a huge harvest. So I think, you know, that's really where I want to be at. I want to be a good-hearted person who clings to God's word, and then just patiently keep producing a huge harvest. It doesn't have to all be done right now. We just patiently keep plugging along. We go to work. We walk with God. We do those two things, and I think fruit will come from that. So if I can leave you with one thing to sum it all up, it's Luke 8:15. Good-hearted people who cling to God's word and patiently produce a huge harvest. Thank you all for coming.